54321. And actually, here we are. We are live. Okay. I am here today with George Neumeyer, and he's the author of The Political Pope, How Pope Francis is Delighting the Liberal Left and Abandoning Conservatives. And a lot of you know him from the Summer of Shame 2018. A lot of the stories on ex-Cardinal Theodore McCarrick were broken and pursued by George Neumeyer. He was doing the journalism that the papers and the news broadcasters weren't doing. He was out there, you know, at the houses and taking photos and getting all these things done. So he did some great work for the church and exposed a lot of things. And he has some more research and journalism coming out. And so, George, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So I don't know if we should begin with McCarrick or if we should do some of the more recent journalism you've been doing on Monsignor Rossi and the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception. Where do you want to start?
Perhaps we should start with Rossi, since that's more immediate.
Sure. So tell everyone who Monsignor Rossi is and then how he fits into this Washington, D.C. network.
Okay, he's the rector at the Basilica of the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception in Washington, D.C., which is one of the most important churches in the United States. It's really it's a church that belongs to all the archdiocese and dioceses of the church in America. And so it's a church that should be of great concern to the bishops. And it's headed up by Monsignor Walter Rossi. His title is rector, and he has been in that position for many years. And he was appointed to that position by Theodore McCarrick. And before that, he was a protege of Monsignor Bishop Bransfield, Michael Bransfield, who has now been suspended from the priesthood for gay predatory behavior and financial crookery. So Rossi's pedigree, is highly revealing. It shows that he's very closely connected to the gay mafia in the Washington, D.C. area. And we've seen in the last year or so that the epicenter of the crisis in the church, the abuse crisis in the church, which is really a gay pederasty crisis, that the epicenter is in Washington, D.C. And Theodore McCarrick is at the center of it. Bransfield's at the center of it. I would argue that Rossi is at the center of it. Wuerl is at the center of it. So you have a collection of either gay mafia practitioners or gay mafia enablers, all in the Washington, D.C. area, many of whom have passed through Catholic University of America. You have David O'Connell, who's the Bishop of Trenton. He's the former president of Catholic U, and all sorts of gay mafia rumors swirl around him. But Rossi, I've been looking at Rossi because, in that triumvirate of McCarrick, Bransfield, and Rossi, the only pillar that hasn't fallen is Rossi. McCarrick is gone, Bransfield is gone, and Rossi should be gone, but he's not gone, even though I have reported and Vigano has confirmed that Rossi has been the subject of accusations of gay predatory behavior behavior in the same mold as Bransfield's or McCarrick's. And I booked that story August. Some alumni came to me and they basically said that, Rossi is a gay sexual harasser. One alumnus called me up and he said Rossi once proposed a threesome with him, and in effect proposed a threesome with him and his gay roommate. And he asked all these sort of insinuating questions. So at the very least, in the parlance of political correctness, Rossi created a hostile workplace, a hostile atmosphere for male students at Catholic U. Right. But there's a lot more to the Rossi story than that. Nobody knows this really, but he was going to become the Bishop of Scranton after Martino withdrew under pressure from liberal priests. And the gay mafia wanted to succeed Martino was Walter Rossi. And Vigano made that comment that Sombi, his predecessor, Archbishop Sombi, had put the kibosh on Rossi's candidacy for to be bishop. Well, that was a reference, a veiled reference to Rossi being a candidate for Scranton, which is where he was ordained. He was ordained in Scranton. And so there was a vetting process that was done. And during that vetting process, all this negative stuff about Rossi came out, and it appalled Sambi. And it even, I think, concerned some folks in Scranton. And so they ultimately chose Bambera, the current Bishop Bambera, the current Bishop of Scranton, to be the candidate instead of Rossi. And yeah. Bambera is, of course, part of the gay mafia, too. His nickname is Bambi, and he's pretty bad, but he's maybe not as bad as Rossi. I mean, Rossi, would have been an outrageous choice on so many different levels. I know stuff that I haven't reported yet about Rossi because I don't have the documentation in hand yet. But when I do, I'll report it. And that stuff doesn't even involve the gay mafia. It's that has to do with other areas of misconduct in Rossi's life. But once I can report that, I think people will understand why Rossi could not be made Bishop of Scranton.
Yeah. You know, with all these allegations, and these are big allegations, I think a lot of people watching don't quite understand all the sort of insider baseball talk. So I want to go back and talk about the Immaculate Conception Basilica and what it is. So some people think this is the Cathedral of America or the Cathedral of D.C., and it's not. This was a major shrine built by the U.S. bishops, and correct me if I'm wrong, George, to consecrate, in a way, America to our patron saint, our patroness, which is Our Lady, the Immaculate Conception. And it's a beautiful basilica with Marian biblical texts and, all of these great Marian apparitions and national devotions to Our Lady. So it's really it's kind of the heart. It's not the cathedral, but it's the heart of the American church. And I think all Catholic Americans need to go and visit this beautiful basilica, this beautiful shrine. So Monsignor Rossi is the rector of that. And rector means, like, I guess the best way to think of it is like a pastor. Right, George?
Right.
He's
right,
the guy in charge. That's right. He's the guy in charge of it. So he's appointed there. Now there's the Cathedral of D.C. That's St. Matthew's, right?
Right.
Yeah, and that's technically the church of the Archbishop Cardinal, like Cardinal Worrell. That would be his cathedral church.
And what's interesting about the cathedral is the pastor there is Monsignor Jameson.
Okay.
And Monsignor Jameson, I discovered, signed a gay marriage petition to promote gay marriage. Mm. You can find Jameson's name on that petition. It's an interfaith petition of all these different liberal ministers and rabbis and priests who support gay marriage. Well, go down the list. People can go down that list and they'll find the name of Monsignor Jameson. And he's the pastor of the most important church in the Archdiocese of Washington. This is the guy that McCarrick selected. This is the guy that Worrell once said to, oh, you can be pastor here for as long as you want. That's what Worrell said to this guy. And he's an out-and-out proponent of gay marriage. So that just tells you how pervasive and deep the gay mafia is in Washington, D.C.
Right. So we have this allegation at the cathedral, and then we've got at the basilica, which is, again, this is like our ground zero. This is the heart of our church. And we have this man, Monsignor Rossi. Now, what is the backstory on Monsignor Rossi? You said he was ordained in Scranton.
Yeah, he was
How did he get to D.C. and how is it that he got this very high plush appointment in the American church?
Well, he was ordained in Scranton, and he had gone to, I believe, the New York the seminary Dunwoody.
Yeah,
I believe to Dunwoody, and he was under the tutelage, I believe, of Edwin O'Brien, who's another gay mafia accused gay mafia cardinal. And then he started out his priestly career in Scranton. And he, I'll just tell you what I know already, which I have a very good source who informed me that Rossi got into trouble as a priest in Scranton. This is according to the source, and I'm basing this on the reliability of the source, and it's a good, he's a very well informed source in Scranton. He, according to this guy, Rossi got drunk one night and. He drove home after he was in a state of great intoxication, and he hit a bunch of parked cars. And he hit like three parked cars, and he just kept going. He didn't stop. He just kept going. And he went back to his rectory, parked, ran into the rectory, and then pretended to have been asleep, when the parked cars had been hit. Well, the police concluded that it was Rossi's car that had put the marks on those cars, and they confronted him at the rectory. He came out apparently. Oops, sorry about that.
That's all right.
Sorry. He apparently came out and pretended like he had been asleep and kind of denied it, but they nailed him, and he eventually had to plead guilty to. I don't know exactly what all he pled guilty to, but I know I was told that he lost his license for at least a year and had to be driven around by parishioners and things like that. So that happened a few years before he left for Washington, D.C. and may have contributed to his decision to get the hell out of Scranton. I don't know. That may not be true. I mean, he might have been planning to go to Catholic U anyways. But then he went to Catholic U to study canon law, and he studied, I think the subject of his thesis was the temporal distribution of goods. That was the subject of his thesis, which is an appropriate subject for Rossi, because Rossi has about at least three separate residences from his Shrine Rectory, two of which are these sort of posh beach condos. So he knows something about the accumulation of temporal goods. But that was the subject of his thesis at Catholic U as a canon lawyer. And while he was studying canon law, he was working at the Shrine under Bishop Michael Bransfield. I believe he was director of pilgrimages. And he and Bransfield were thick as thieves. And so Bransfield took a liking to Rossi and saw him as a potential successor. And Bransfield no doubt introduced Rossi to Theodore McCarrick, and Theodore McCarrick also took a liking to Rossi. And Rossi became sort of the fair-haired boy of Bransfield and McCarrick. And when Bransfield went on to West Virginia, you know, because he wanted to get his hands on all that oil money that he knew was out there, you know, money which would allow him to pursue his double life and his desire for opulence to the maximum, he then no doubt encouraged McCarrick to make Rossi his successor, and that's what happened. McCarrick named Rossi to that position, and Rossi has run the Shrine in pretty much the same way that Bransfield ran it. And I've heard some pretty hair-raising stories actually about the Bransfield Rossi regime. There's one story actually I was told by a church mouse, a woman who used to go to the Shrine all the time. She said that she knew one of the guards, the security guards, an old black gentleman. And one day, this was during the Bransfield years, and Rossi was the director of pilgrimages, according to this source. And the old black man had told this church mouse about a party that had been held within the basilica late at night, that he had been forced to work, in effect. He was told by Bransfield or somebody at the Shrine that he had to organize parking for this party. So this old black man had to organize the parking for this party. Well, it turned out that the party was a party for gay priests along the Eastern Seaboard. And they were in the rectory late at night, and the security guard told the church mouse that he witnessed these gay priests running around the church, running around the crypt, running into the sacristy, and they were kissing each other and fooling around and drinking. And so that was the kind of atmosphere that
existed. Mean down in the crypt church of the basilica?
Yeah, this was actually at the church. And this, I'm not even talking about the parties they held at the Shrine Rectory, which were notoriously campy and inappropriate. This was actually a party that was held within the basilica late after all the visitors had gone and late at night. And so this old black man, when he was recounting this story to this church mouse, he was practically having a nervous breakdown because he just could not believe what he had been seeing. And unfortunately, that gentleman has passed away, and I can't, you know, confirm the story through him. But I am confident enough in my source that I think that, you know, that was the self-indulgent gay atmosphere that existed at the Basilica under Bransfield and Rossi. And it's continued to exist under Rossi. I mean, you can look up pictures on Google of Rossi dressing up for Mardi Gras, you know, with other members of his staff. And it's, you know, they look like they're, you know, in the Castro in San Francisco. You know, it's very campy and seemingly, you know, it's not the kind of thing that should be happening at one of the most important churches in the country. But, you know, the other obvious irony is that, you know, this immensely important church that is dedicated to the purity of Mary is in the hands of a credibly accused gay predator, you know, and has been for at least the last two. Bransfield was a gay predator. Rossi's a gay predator. And then I was told that a previous rector before Bransfield was also a member of the gay mafia, and that he may have died actually of AIDS. I'm still checking on that one. He went out and he died mysteriously in California. People don't know exactly what he died of, but some people suspect that he died of AIDS. So it could be that the last three rectors, or with the, you know, I might be getting, it's possible that three of the last four rectors were members of the gay mafia. And the river of filth that has been, you know, that runs, that we've witnessed over the last, you know, year or so, it runs straight through the shrine, and it runs straight through Catholic University of America. Mm-hmm. And David O'Connell, who was the former president, you know, he was part of that Rossi, Bransfield, McCarrick web of corruption. In fact, he played a role in trying to suppress a story about one of Rossi's alleged lovers, Father Matthew Riedlinger, who got ensnared in a sexting scandal. He thought he was talking to a 16-year-old. It turned out to be somebody working with the cops, and he exchanged something like, you know, or sent something like over 1,000 messages to this person. So at any rate,
this is a priest of which diocese?
He had been ordained, outrageously enough, in Trenton, even though he had started off his priestly path in Toledo. I was told he was actually studying to be a priest in the Toledo diocese, but he apparently was kicked out of that diocese, and he turned up at Catholic U and became, I'm told, a lover of Monsignor Rossi's. And Rossi then, I don't know how long that relationship lasted, but Rossi played a role in pulling strings for Riedlinger so that Riedlinger could become a priest in Trenton. And at the time, John Smith was the bishop of Trenton, and John Smith was a crony of Theodore McCarrick's. They had gone to seminary together. And so apparently what happened was Rossi just called over to McCarrick and said, "Hey, could you find a diocese for my boyfriend?" And so then McCarrick apparently just called down to his buddy, John Smith in Trenton, and said, "Can you ordain Rossi's boyfriend?" And John Smith did. And then John Smith retired, and he was replaced by David O'Connell, who had been at Catholic U and was connected to the gay mafia at Catholic U and would have been on very friendly terms with Rossi and Bransfield and McCarrick. And in fact, O'Connell has been alleged to have had boyfriends at Catholic U, including a student, actually, by the way. But he's alleged to have been, not only just an enabler of gay mafia, but a practitioner of it. That's an allegation, but I've heard it sufficiently from enough people to think that there's some credibility to it. At any rate, David O'Connell goes down and he becomes the bishop of Trenton, and then Riedlinger gets ensnared in the sexting scandal. And so then Rossi's got to call O'Connell and say, "Hey, you got to cover for this guy who's in trouble with the law." And Riedlinger, or O'Connell did. He put Riedlinger on a kind of vague leave of absence without telling anybody why he was on leave of absence. He never told the congregation at his parish why he left, that it was because he had been nabbed in a sexting. He didn't tell them that for about a year. For about a year, he didn't tell them anything about the circumstances of Riedlinger's disappearance. And in fact, during that period when he had left his parish in New Jersey, Riedlinger was staying at Monsignor Rossi's beach condo near Atlantic City. And I know, and to this day, Riedlinger gets mail at that condo and in fact is registered to vote at the condo. I found records to that effect. And when I was there,
so that's pretty, the mailman, I mean, that's connecting the dots
The mailman happened to be there the day I was checking out that condo. And I said to him, "You probably don't want to talk to a reporter." And the mailman said, "No, I'll talk to you." And I said, does Matthew Riedlinger get mail at this address?" And the mailman said, "Yes, he does." Well, that could just be a coincidence, or it could just be, you know, that his name was never taken off the rolls of that, you know, particular outfit. But because I know that Riedlinger is now married to a man in Wayne, New Jersey, and he works at a furniture store. and he's out of the priesthood. He left the priesthood. So when he ultimately was kicked out of the priesthood, basically he was removed from the priesthood. David O'Connell at that point did tell the congregation that it had to do with sexual misconduct, but he never told them that it involved sending thousands of texts to a person that Riedlinger considered to be underage. He never told them that. So he was participating in just a massive cover up that had been orchestrated by Rossi. And so that's really the Riedlinger scandal is something that has not been sufficiently ventilated, even though one New Jersey paper, talked about it. And I've talked about it. But, most of the Catholic press has just ignored it. And yet it's a very illuminating chapter in Rossi's priestly career that he was, that he had made one of his alleged lovers a priest and then covered for him and may have even acted as a kind of pimp for him, because the students, the investigation into Riedlinger was prompted by students who said that Riedlinger had been hitting on them and that Riedlinger had been introduced to them by Rossi. And that's part of Rossi's story, is that he's not only an alleged gay predator, he's also alleged to have been a pimp of sorts for the bishops and for McCarrick and for other priests and other people at Catholic U.
Yeah, I mean, you see the spheres kind of coming together here. So you have Theodore McCarrick, and, he goes way back with sexual abuse and sexual predation into as early as 1971, we have documented, right? So we've got that connection, and we've got this giant gay cabal, which I've discussed in my book, Infiltration, which goes back to Europe. It's connected to the United States and Europe. And then we have Washington, D.C. with all this political power. I mean, just recently we've seen this Epstein charges, right, in D.C. Yep. And on the Eastern Seaboard. It involves Bill Clinton. And it's sort of raising these questions about Pizzagate and, yep, child trafficking, human trafficking in Washington, D.C. And that, of course, raises the red flag, and it raises the question, and I'd like to ask you about that. Do you think that the political celebrity human trafficking is linked with the ecclesial trafficking in D.C.?
I haven't studied that sufficiently to give you a good answer. Because the Epstein scandal is a heterosexual pederasty scandal, it probably doesn't link up with the church scandal, which is essentially a homosexual pederasty scandal. But on the other hand, McCarrick, was so well connected, and he was so beloved by the political class, that it would not surprise me if it comes out that McCarrick pimped out young men to politicians in Washington, D.C. That would not surprise me at all. It would not surprise me if McCarrick was attending gay parties and with gay politicians, and of both right and left, of both the Republicans and the Democrats. We all know that D.C. is probably the gayest city in America after San Francisco. It's chock-a-block full of homosexuals, and there had to have been an overlap between McCarrick's gay circle and the political class's gay circle. But because Epstein was into women, was into underage women or girls, I doubt the Epstein scandal is going to reveal any church connections.
Right. Okay. So let's try to, why would this be structured this way? We already have the Cardinal Archbishop. We got McCarrick lined up. So Rossi was appointed in 2005. Is that right? To the Basilica? Monsignor Rossi?
I believe so. Yeah.
And so was that the year, I'm trying to remember the year that McCarrick left and Worrell came in. Was that 2006?
Something like that. It may have happened around 2005, 2006, 2007. That would have been, it probably was 2005. Because we know McCarrick was there when, because McCarrick had supported John Kerry in 2004. And so it would have been around 2005 when he appointed Rossi.
So I was living in D.C. 06, 07, I believe, yeah. And I remember meeting then Cardinal McCarrick. And I believe it was sort of an interregnum situation. I don't, I'm trying to remember if he was still the Archbishop and if Wuerl had come in. I just looked it up here on online. So Wuerl's tenure ended May 16th, 2006, is when McCarrick, his resignation was accepted. So May 6th. So he would have been the one that appointed Rossi to the shrine, which is what you said earlier, right?
Yeah. McCarrick appointed Rossi to the shrine, yeah. And then Wuerl had the power to change the rector, and he never did. He's backed Rossi to the hilt.
Right.
But the Archbishop of Washington, D.C. is the chairman of the Basilica, which makes him, in effect, the the person who can hire and fire at the Basilica.
Right. And then I'm trying to find the entry date here for Wuerl. He begins, looks like he's installed June 22nd, 2006. So just a little bit over a month after McCarrick leaves. So there was a little gap there. It's 2006 that the transition happens. Now, where does Cardinal Wuerl fit in all of this? You did a lot of trailing and researching, and how does he fit? I mean, we know about McCarrick. That's a slam dunk. We have these allegations that seem to have some substantiating evidence and facts. Hasn't all been put out there yet regarding Rossi, but it seems to me that the missing link in all of this is Cardinal Wuerl and how he fits in with the succession turnover from McCarrick into what we currently have now in 2019. So explain that to us.
Well, he served primarily as the enabler of McCarrick and Rossi and Bransfield and others, that he protected them. We know for a fact that he knew that McCarrick had made an advance upon a priest, Sielek, that Father Sielek, and
yes,
because Sielek himself had told Wuerl about that many years before he became Archbishop of Washington. So Wuerl can't claim. I mean, I know Wuerl has said that he forgot. He forgot about what Sielek had said to him, which is like saying that you forgot that you were in a plane crash once, or that a tiger once took off one of your toes. I forgot that. There are certain things you never forget, and one thing would be a priest telling you, "Hey, this very powerful man in the church made a sexual advance upon me." So
the Wuerl most powerful in American church, right?
Yeah. So Wuerl is lying through his teeth, just as Vigano said. Vigano said Wuerl lies shamelessly. And that's a shameless lie. So he protected McCarrick. He had to have known about Bransfield, because Bransfield and Wuerl have always been very close. In fact, I was told that when Bransfield, Wuerl, and Rossi would have lunch together at the Basilica cafeteria, this one guy described it as a scene out of Mean Girls. It was like a scene from Mean Girls. I mean, these are very kind of campy, bitchy guys who are totally dedicated to the pursuit of money and opulence and living as comfortably as possible and prestige they're very vain. Donald Wuerl had a high school named after himself in Pittsburgh, which 12 days after the grand jury report, his name had to be scraped off the school. I was the only person actually who ever discussed that as an issue many years ago. I said, how in the world could the face of the Church of Pope Francis be a guy who had a high school named after himself? Isn't that the very definition of self-interested clericalism, which Pope Francis claims to be so against? And yet nobody seemed to care. Whenever I raised that issue, I said, Donald Wuerl's got a school named after himself. He had a school named after himself. How is that consistent with the Church of Francis? And people would just shrug and they give excuses. They say, "Oh, that was named by somebody else," which is nonsense. It's a cardinal. Makes the call on whether or not a school is named after him. I mean, give me a break. But so Bransfield and Wuerl, they're all in the same circle. They're in the same social circle. And they have the same interests, and Wuerl, while Wuerl has never been revealed to be a practitioner of the game, within the game mafia. Rumors to that effect have swirled around him for years and years and years. And in fact, one thing that I would love somebody to get their hands on is a deposition that had been given by a disgruntled seminarian many, many years ago, 20 plus years ago in Pittsburgh. A guy named Tim Bendig gave a deposition in a case where he had sued the Diocese of Pittsburgh for failing to protect him from a priest who had abused him. And in the course of his deposition, Bendig started to retail gossip from the seminary, stuff that he had heard from other seminarians. And one of the things he had heard from other seminarians was that Donald Wuerl had a boyfriend at the seminary. And so he included that in his deposition. He said that in his deposition that, oh, I've heard the seminarian say that there's a guy who comes out of Wuerl's room with his hair messed up, so something to that effect. And I'm told by multiple parties to the deposition that not only was that said, but that those comments played a role in hastening the church's decision to settle the case before it got to trial. And so that deposition, I guess, nobody has a legal right to see the deposition, but somebody must have it, and it's got to be in the archives of the Pittsburgh Diocese. And if Zubik is truly committed to transparency, he'll release it and let members of the press and public see that document. But that's the most concrete document in suggesting that Wuerl is not only an enabler of the gay mafia, he's a participant in it too. Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to go back to the Father Selig case. So this was a settlement in 2005, in which he said that McCarrick there was sexual misconduct with McCarrick, and obviously Wuerl knew about it, right? I think his name is on a document involved in it. Do you know about that?
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. That came out even before before Selig said, I talked to Wuerl about this directly.
Right.
He told me that he forwarded my complaint to the nuncio.
Yeah. And then, as I understand it, Wuerl denied having any knowledge of that. And then they came back and he said, well, that he was imprecise, that they referred to claims only against minors and not adults. But then Selig came out and he says, I refuse to accept this.
Right.
What Wuerl's saying, and here's the quote, I just pulled it up. This is Selig, who received the settlement. I do not believe for one moment that he, that's Wuerl, I do not believe that for one moment that he forgot, but substantively it doesn't all add up. He's shown himself to be better at expressing sorrow for actions of others, but he remains unable or unwilling to acknowledge the truth of his own actions. End quote. So, yeah, I mean, it is odd if your boss is someone that's very powerful, like a Steve Jobs or a Donald Trump type person, right? Like Cardinal McCarrick was the American prelate. And someone comes and says, hey, I'm getting this settlement from your successor, this great cardinal, and you would forget about that. I mean, that's something that you would probably think about at night quite a bit. Like, oh my goodness, the person who came before me is going into the settlement over gay sexual misconduct.
Yeah.
I mean,
Wuerl for the next, immediately after he came in, he allowed McCarrick to be near seminarians. He allowed him to be near seminarians. Mm-hmm. He feted him. Like he'd allow McCarrick to concelebrate masses. McCarrick was always getting favorable write-ups in the diocesan paper. The Catholic Charities building was named after, a program was named after McCarrick, or one of the buildings was named after McCarrick, something like the Archbishop McCarrick, Cardinal McCarrick Center, something like that. They only took it off like a month or so after the grand jury, around the time the grand jury report was released, they finally took it off. But he allowed all that to go on, that all the celebrations of McCarrick and all the proximity of McCarrick to seminarians and to young people, that all happened with Wuerl's support, even though he knew perfectly well that McCarrick was a gay predator. And he would have known about, he has access to the internet like everybody else, and he's got an army of media aides, and they have access to the internet, and they would have known about what Richard Sipe had said concerning McCarrick, which he said 15 years ago. which he wrote about 15 years ago. Site published an open letter to Benedict about how McCarrick was a gay predator, you know, and how there wasn't just one episode, but multiple episodes. So
how does this tie in with Vigano's letter? Because Vigano actually addresses it.
Well, you mean the Selig testimony or
Just where, you know, I think you mentioned it before, where Vigano says that Worrell lies shamelessly.
And he has this chief of staff. He prevails upon his chief of staff, senior Charles Anticinelli, to lie to. And you know what? You know where Anticinelli is today?
Where is he? We don't
know. He is the chief of staff to Wilton Gregory.
Nothing
has changed. Absolutely nothing has changed. All of the bad guys under Worrell are still in power under Gregory. And it's just amazing. And Rossi's a perfect example of that. You know, why hasn't Gregory removed Rossi from the rectorship of the Basilica? You know, why is he, Gregory is committed to creating a, you know, giving the Archdiocese of Washington a fresh start, the first and most obvious thing he should do is fire Walter Rossi.
Yeah. So this raises the question, why is this going nowhere? We just had this huge scandal in D.C. with McCarrick. And honestly, I mean, you know, you showed that McCarrick was still living in D.C. He was at that home.
He was living at 411 Warren Street in a seven-figure, $1 million home owned by the Archdiocese of Washington that had been used as a kind of retirement home by I think Cardinal O'Boyle or I'm not maybe getting the name Baum or one of those a couple of retired bishops lived there. It's a nice it's a very nice house on the edge of American University and about three blocks from like a childcare center, by the way. The Washington Post, by the way, knew this and never reported it.
Amazing.
They knew it and never reported it. I found it out through a great source in the Archdiocese of Washington. And I just, to confirm that McCarrick was there, I just decided, because I had very limited time. I mean, I couldn't do a 24-hour stakeout or something. I had to make things happen. So what I did was I just went up to the front door. I rang the doorbell. And the housekeeper came out, and I said, I'd like to talk to Theodore McCarrick. I know he's upstairs. And the housekeeper starts lying and says, oh, he's not here. And I said, I know that Bishop Mario Dorsonville lives here. And she's like, oh, he doesn't live here. Well, he does live there. So at any rate, I engaged this woman in conversation, and I eventually kind of got myself into the house. And I could see pictures of Worrell up on the wall. And so it was very obviously an archdiocesan safe house or property. And so then Mario Dorsonville came back actually about a half hour after this. And I saw him go into the garage and I went up to him and I said, Theodore McCarrick's in there, isn't he? And Mario Dorsonville did not say no. He looked at me with this very funny expression like, yeah, he is, but he didn't say that. He just sort of was, his body language was very revealing, and it revealed that McCarrick was up there. And of course he was up there. Ed McFadden, the communications director for Worrell, about a half hour after I had talked to Dorsonville, he shows up, you know, and he made a great, you know, scene of he was going to escort the housekeeper to her car because she was so traumatized by having to deal with a reporter. And then I started asking McFadden. I said, McCarrick's there. Have him come down here and talk to reporters. The guy still hasn't apologized for what he did to these people. I mean, he's never repented. He's never talked about it. He's never been opened himself up to questions. This was a great opportunity for the media to get some questions out of this guy, out of this monster. And of course, nobody took. I called the Washington Post. I called Michelle Borstein, and I said, I'm standing in front of the house where McCarrick is hiding. Couldn't you, you know, doesn't the Washington Post think that's a newsworthy story? And she starts hemming and hawing and saying, oh, I can't come, and I can't get anybody else to come. You know, it wouldn't do any good anyways. And that they would never take that attitude if, you know, some disgraced Trump official was hiding somewhere and hiding in a house.
Right.
They'd have a scrum down there in about 10 seconds. In fact, they remember during the Brent Kavanaugh hearing, they sent out a contingent of reporters to find his buddy, Mark Judge, in a beach house in Rehoboth Beach. So that was really important. But McCarrick, this rapist, this monster, clericalist monster, he's right there. They had an opinion writer. I can't remember her name, but she had gone to that house, but wasn't free to report on what had happened. She didn't report that she had gone to Warren Street house. She never reported it, even though she sort of takes credit. And, I don't know how you take credit for a story that you never actually published, but she's kind of done. I'm the only person who actually published and said, McCarrick is at 411 Warren Street. I think that's the correct address, 411 Warren Street. And he was there. He was there because the next day they moved him. They had to, I think he went out to Virginia for a day, and then he came back, and then he had a 24/7 security guard in front of the house. Like, if you had gone over to that house at 2 o'clock in the morning, that security guard would have been there. And it was because he wasn't guarding Dorsonville. He wasn't guarding that housekeeper. He was guarding Theodore McCarrick. In fact, I was with an associate from the American Spectator the day I discovered this. And I remember Dorsonville left, the housekeeper had left, and then about an hour later, a light coat goes on one of the rooms upstairs. And it's like, how'd that light go on? If there were only two people in the house, it was McCarrick. McCarrick was there. And then the presence of the security guard was confirmation of that. And by the way, the security guard was working for Mark Sullivan, who was the disgraced Secret Service director for Barack Obama. Donald Wuerl hired this disgraced Obama Secret Service director, Mark Sullivan, who happens to be a Catholic, who happens to be a parishioner at Little Flower in Bethesda. Mm. He hired his firm of security goons to protect McCarrick on the faithful's dime. And I had adventures with that group of people. Like, I had some hairy, scary episodes with those guys because they were not pleased that I was encroaching upon their space, as it were. And I could go into that. It's a different.
Wasn't there pressure during this time period, both in churches by the lay people, and it seems that there were also priests in the diocese, a presbyteral pressure at the time for Cardinal Wuerl to step down? I mean, I can't remember the exact month of all of this, but there was a few weeks there where, I mean, it was almost impossible for Wuerl to appear in public.
Yeah, he went to Rome in, I think it was August of last year, and the purpose of the visit was to get advice from the Pope on how to proceed, and the Pope said to him, you got to go back to your priest and get a vote of confidence. And so they scheduled this priestly barbecue and conference at Little Flower in Bethesda, and he did not get a vote of confidence at that event. And one of the reasons why he didn't get a vote of confidence at that event was that I had gone to the event, and I had my presence there resulted in six police cars showing up to the event before the priests had arrived. So because I was there, Mark Sullivan, the guy I was talking about, and the pastor, I can't remember his name, and then Ed McFadden and those guys, they said, oh, Neumeier's here. He's going to create trouble. He could possibly create trouble. We got to call the police. And it's like, it was just me, an associate of mine from the Spectator, and a guy on his bike, and maybe a housewife or one or housewife. It was like a very small group of people. But at any rate, they call the police, and six police cars show up, right? And so that's what greets the priests when they arrive for their meeting with Wuerl, six police cars. Oh. And so these guys are thinking, every time we're going to meet with Wuerl, we're going to have to deal with police, a police presence. Every occasion, every event, the Archdiocese of Washington is going to become a potential protest. So I think that kind of rattled the priests, and it made them think, we desperately need a fresh start here. And so then the meeting starts, and I was told that a bunch of priests basically told Wuerl, you got to get out. And one indication that the meeting went horribly was that Wuerl didn't stay for the dinner. He did not stay for the dinner. He blessed the dinner and then took off. Mm-hmm. And it was because he did not get that vote of confidence, which the Pope had told him he needed to get. And so from then on, it was the handwriting was on the wall. And then to completely stop the protest, Wuerl announced that he was going to plead with the Pope to accept his resignation. And that kind of stopped the protest. And then there was that kabuki dance in Rome where, Francis said, you've shown such nobility and, you're taking responsibility for things you didn't do and that kind of thing. And then he was named apostolic administrator. and was allowed to stay in that position way, you know, for way longer than he should have, you know, for months and months and months. And then they were actually going to name, I'm told they were going to name Tobin from New Jersey, the whole, you know, Cardinal Tobin. But that, I played a role in scuttling that because I found out that a gay looking Italian actor, Francesco Castiglione, was living in the rector, in Tobin's rectory. And
what's the story on that? I mean,
yeah, well, he was, and I confirmed it.
And it's confirmed that he was living there?
I went up to Tobin at the Baltimore USCCB conference in the fall, and I said, did Francesco Castiglione live in your rectory? And Tobin was popped, and he said, yeah, he did, temporarily. And I said, why would a Seton Hall student be living in your rectory? It's against stated diocesan policy to have non-priests living in rectories. And he said, oh, he started hemming and hawing and said, oh, you'll have to talk to so-and-so. And so, but everybody thinks, many of the priests and parishioners in Newark, they think that that gay-looking Italian actor was the real recipient of Tobin's infamous 90-night baby tweet. Message.
It's very odd that never mind a priest, but not a bit, a cardinal would have a model. Was he a model? Who was this guy? He's an actor.
He's like a half baked soap actor. You know.
Okay, so he's an actor.
He's an actor, and he was supposedly at Seton Hall taking voice lessons and learning English. What happened apparently was that I reported that he was living at the rectory, and that caused a panic, and they put him on a plane back to Italy in effect. And now he's back in Italy.
Yeah, but he was at CUA, student.
No, well, he was at Seton Hall.
Seton Hall, which is in New Jersey.
That's where seminary for the for Newark is.
Yeah, Immaculate Conception, isn't it? Is that the name of the seminary? I think so.
I'm not sure, but the whole thing just reeked of impropriety.
It's not good optics, folks.
Yeah,
it's not good optics when you have a young layman Italian actor living in your house when you're a cardinal.
Yeah, just your viewers should look up Francesco Castiglione on Google, and just one picture of him will tell you the story of why Tobin had him living at the rectory.
Yeah. Yeah, and there was the night baby that went back and all that. Man, what a mess. So, you know, a lot of what I kind of want to know is you know, I talked about some of these stories and I followed them and I followed your stuff, but everything's kind of gone quiet, and we have the new Archbishop Wilton Gregory, who was installed earlier this summer, wasn't it? May? Where does that fit into all this? I mean, it seems to me that Wuerl, in a way, is still in power. He still has the influence. He got an honorable discharge from the diocese. Why Wilton Gregory? Why is he now the new point man in D.C.? And no doubt he'll become a cardinal.
Well, he's a kind of placeholder. He's 71, I believe. And so he's, you know, it's kind of strange to appoint a 71-year-old to a archdiocese, and so he's a placeholder, but he's also an errand boy in effect for Wuerl. I mean, Wuerl, I think he succeeded in getting Francis to find somebody who would serve him as a protector in effect, and so Gregory is allowing Wuerl. I've been told that Wuerl is actually going to live at the seminary, John Paul II Seminary. He had been building a retirement home there, or a retirement residence on the first floor, a very posh retirement apartment on the first floor. And so I've been told that that's actually happening, that he's actually going to move in there. And these seminarians, I've been told that seminarians are just appalled that, you know, this gay mafia cardinal, this complete and total fraud and liar who was responsible for allowing the McCarrick scandal to mushroom and discredit the archdiocese, he's going to be living down the hall from the seminarians or you know, within close proximity of them, and they're appalled by that. They don't want to be anywhere near Wuerl, and yet Gregory apparently has signed off on it. And Gregory, you know, as I said, he's made Wuerl's chief of staff his chief of staff. You know, how much more business as usual can you be than that? You know,
yeah, you keep the chief of staff, and then you keep the rector at the shrine.
Yeah, then you have the Rector. Worrell's, you know, Worrell's enforcer at the Shrine is, you know, he's still there, and then you have countless other examples of Chico Noguchi, the this very odd media aide to Worrell. She, I believe, is now the director of communications under Gregory, which is insane.
Uh-oh, you still there? There was a buzz.
Are you there?
There you're back. There was a buzz and you went kind of still, but you're back. You're back.
Yeah, so at any rate, all these people like Chico Noguchi should have lost her job, you know, last year. And yet now she's, I believe, I'll have to double check this, but I believe she's the director of communication under Gregory. The only casualty that I've heard of from the Worrell regime is Ed McFadden. Ed McFadden has left, and so I guess he must not have been offered a job by Gregory.
Oh, so he was Worrell's communication guy.
Yeah, right? he was Worrell's. Okay. He was the communications director under Worrell, and I believe that Chico Noguchi, Worrell's right hand woman, as it were, she is now the director of communications for Gregory. I believe. I need to double check. But I know she is not lost. She's not unemployed, and she's still working for the Archdiocese. I know that for certain. Yeah.
Right. You know, when
Gregory has moved into he's moved into that palatial penthouse on Embassy Row at the top of Our Lady Queen of the Americas building that Worrell occupied and poured hundreds of thousands of dollars into to make it as comfortable as possible for him and his buddies. Gregory, you know, who has the same taste for high living as Worrell, very quickly moved into that place. And, you know, because remember Gregory down in Atlanta had built a $2.2 million.
Yeah.
Buckhead, the Beverly Hills of Atlanta. And people were so mad at him for doing that. And it was so contrary to the supposed spirit of Francis that he basically had to say, okay, I screwed up and I'll sell the place off.
So did they, because I had heard that too, that they built a $2.2 million residence for Archbishop Gregory in where was it?
Buckhead, which is
Atlanta area.
Richest part of Atlanta, yeah.
Okay.
But now he's at a $2.2 million.
Did they sell it? Did they sell it or keep it?
Yeah, they sold it. Sold it. And but now he's probably in a $3 million penthouse, at least. It might be more. I've been told that penthouse at the top is 12,000 square feet. And so it's likely worth, it could be worth as much as that top floor could be, like, you know, it could be like worth $15 million. And Worrell put all this marble in there. He put a barbecue deck on top. He hired these architects to either build or improve a chapel, which nobody even knew about. Nobody even knew there was a chapel there until I reported it 5 years ago in the Daily Caller, I guess it was 5 years ago. And then he also poured hundreds of thousands of dollars into the personal residence part of the floor for himself. Mm. And he used to live with his secretaries, but he lived with at least one of his, I can't remember how many secretaries he had. He had one, he'd always have one secretary living with him. But what I found out one time 5 years ago that he also had a quote unquote personal chef. This guy, this very odd, peculiar character. I ran into him coming out of Worrell's garage at 10:30 at night or so, and he was in a white, flashy white Mercedes. And I said to the guy, I said, "Who are you? You know, why are you coming out of Worrell's garage at 10:30?" And he said very sort of weirdly, he said, "I'm the personal chef of Donald Worrell." And I said, "I didn't know he had a personal chef." And he said, I'm an archdiocesan employee. And I said, "Oh, okay, I'll check that out with the archdiocese." Well, I checked it out with the archdiocese. They would never confirm that this guy was an archdiocesan employee. And then after my story came out, the guy disappeared. I was told by the building manager across the way. He said that the guy had just disappeared, and that for a couple of days after my story, the guy was still there. And he wouldn't park his car in the garage. He'd park it in the employee lot where he should have been parking it all along. So that situation just reeked to high heaven. And I still don't know who that guy is and what exactly his relationship to Worrell is and whether or not he was a personal chef or if he had a portfolio a little broader than that.
You know, when I heard that Wilton Gregory was chosen to replace Wuerl, the thing that stuck out to me was is that he was consecrated a bishop by, drumroll please, Cardinal Bernardin.
Sure.
The notorious predator, gay cabal, Cardinal of Chicago, who was best buddies with Cardinal McCarrick.
Right.
And we've had this allegation that's come out by James Grind saying that he was molested not only by Wuerl, not only by McCarrick, but also by Bernardin in the presence of McCarrick. So this is really mad. So also, Wilton Gregory was the master of ceremonies, the MC for Bernardin. So he's kind of one of the insiders with early on with Bernardin. That doesn't mean anything, but it doesn't look good that you've been promoted and consecrated by, you know, the twin. It's coming out, the sexual predator twin of McCarrick. It's not good. Why'd they choose Gregory?
Yeah, well, yeah, it just shows you that the Church of Francis is a church of cover-ups, and it's not a church of fresh starts. Mm-mm. It's this is kind of like the last gasp of Amchurch, as the Wanderer used to call it, before the attorney generals pull the plug on the whole damn thing. I think that, you know, they want Gregory is going to play defense for Wuerl, play defense for Rossi, play defense for all these other guys. But at some point, the attorney generals, U.S. attorney, perhaps the attorney general for D.C., perhaps the attorney general for Maryland, they're going to deliver some knockout punches in the coming years. And so I think this is sort of the last gasp of Amchurch.
Yeah, it's remarkable that they actually didn't try. I mean, you would think they'd be afraid enough to do and they'd go for a clean start, but they actually didn't. I mean, they're pretty brazen. They still think they're going to get away with it. I mean, they kind of threw McCarrick under the bus. There's this unfortunate info coming out about Bernardin. Yeah, I mean, they're still pushing through it.
They think that they can offer up a few sacrificial lambs and then proceed about their business. But there are just too many investigations, and the laity is too angry, I think, for them to get away with it, you know. But, you know, a guy like Wuerl, he learned his sort of deviousness at the knee of John Wright, Cardinal John Wright, who was a very credibly accused pederast. Okay, member of the gay mafia, one of the chief godfathers of the gay mafia, along with Spellman and some other folks. But, you know, some people argue that we're now in like the fourth generation of the gay mafia. And that subject really needs more examination.
My research, if you look at infiltration, I believe that the gay mafia begins in the early 50s, maybe late 40s. But
I think
my take on it, what do you think?
Randy Engel has argued that she thinks it goes all the way back to the 1920s, I think. There was that gay Boston cardinal. Was it O'Connell? Am I getting the name right? O'Connell?
Yeah, I don't want to say because
he was a contemporary of Spellman's. But Spellman, of course, who his dates go back right to the 40s, right? At least the 40s, maybe even
he had a 30s. He had a long reign.
But he is undeniably one of the he was on the ground floor of the gay mafia, and so I push it back to at least the 30s.
Yeah, so Cardinal Spellman is installed in 1939.
Okay.
Yeah, and he ends in 1967. So he had a very long tenure at New York as Cardinal Archbishop there, and of course was very involved in the young Theodore McCarrick's vocation and ministry. So, yeah, not good. So that would, you know, that would, again, so if he comes in 39, I think that he was probably transforming the New York diocese in the 40s. And so by the 50s, you start having this, it seems to me it's an Eastern Seaboard, these dioceses, but then it spreads to Chicago and then the rest of the nation. But I really think it's happening late 40s and then getting traction in the 50s. And then, and then getting really bad in the 60s, and then you start seeing all the the house is burning down in the 70s and the 80s when all this stuff goes into the public.
Yeah, and John Quinn, the Archbishop of San Francisco, was also very close to Bernardine, and that relationship needs to be examined too, because John Quinn was sort of the godfather of the gay mafia on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's in Mahoney and all that. I mean, you kind of see New York and D.C. They work with Chicago, and then you see L.A. and then they start appointing bishops, right, on the western side of the U.S. But it's really, I think, those three dioceses, four: the New York, D.C., the Chicago, the L.A., and that pretty much is the U.S. But it seems that D.C. was always the leader. And, McCarrick was obviously the linchpin of the whole thing.
Well, there is a story about, I should know this, but there's a French theologian of some prominence who, I need to find out his name, but he mysteriously in the 70s turned up at Catholic U and decided to teach at Catholic University. And nobody, these prominent, other equally prominent theologians were wondering, like, why would this guy go to Catholic U? It didn't have a particularly good reputation. In fact, it was seen as a kind of backwater. And so they were like, why did this French theologian, why would he want to teach at Catholic U? Well, it turned out that the reason why he wanted to teach at Catholic U is that he had a boyfriend in Washington. And that was confirmed the day after he retired, when he got married to that boyfriend and moved into a house on Capitol Hill. And so stories like
that. What's the date? What's the date? Date on that?
That would have been in the 70s. I really need to get his name, but I've heard stories along those lines about DC for years and years and years. And as I said before, DC is a very gay city, and then when you combine that with a very gay church, which the Catholic Church became in the 20th century, it was a pretty flammable mix, and it explains why the Archdiocese of Washington became the epicenter of the scandal.
Yeah. So you kind of hinted earlier that you think that we'll start seeing the attorney generals come in. Do you think we'll see a RICO situation, racketeering in the U.S.?
I don't know. I think, RICO is one of those things where you have to prove that an action was taken for financial reasons, financial motive. So if RICO is invoked or is applied, it'll probably be in relationship to the Papal Foundation, which was clearly created by Theodore McCarrick and John Kroll, among others, to buy the Vatican's silence and the Vatican's inattention to their scandals. And that's a financial, so if they were committing financial crimes in order to enrich themselves and in order to inoculate themselves against any scrutiny from the Vatican, that may fall close enough to the RICO that it could actually be applied. But a lot of these cases, the financial motive isn't that clear, and so I would assume that the government would hesitate before using RICO. But I do think that it'll probably come out that bishops have been trading like child porn with each other for years, and that if there's any financial angle to that, that could certainly trigger a RICO case. But because that criminal activity across state lines, like if Bernardine was sending child porn to some other bishop in another state, and they had some financial motive for doing so, that could actually be a RICO case.
Well, what about the one I've heard is what about just, okay, you've got this priest who's a pederast, sending him across state lines to another diocese. Does that count also or not?
If they were doing so to make money, RICO would apply.
So the money. Yeah. It's got to have the money.
Yeah, that's what I was told by a very high-ranking member of the Justice Department. He said you have to establish a financial motive for RICO.
Okay. Speaking of finances, how are things financially in D.C.? Do you have any research on that? Are people closing their wallets up? Are people ticked that we're still around, or are people forgotten?
I need to do more research on that. I haven't seen if giving has fallen off. I think, the Archdiocese of Washington has a huge endowment. It's accumulated so many properties, and it's worth a lot of money. So even outrageously irresponsible as these guys are, and how wasteful they as they are, and how much money that's been spent on abuse cases, the church in Washington still is flush with money, and still has assets and properties that will allow these guys to continue to live like the Borgias. But you know, at some point, reality is going to catch up with the church in Washington, and I would assume that the annual Archbishop's appeal, I think it will reflect a certain, an anger on the part of the laity, and a recognition that it's better to just give money directly to orders and to, people who are doing undeniably good work, just put the money into their hands rather than give it to the Archbishop, who often just is, he takes that money and he uses it for clericalist purposes.
Right. Any predictions for the next USCCB meeting in November of this year, 2019?
Basically the topic is going to remain the same, that how do we get over the abuse scandal? How do we move on? One of the good things about the scandal is that it's completely silenced the bishops when it comes to left-wing politics. They have no credibility.
Yeah, but they're still talking immigration and all these other things.
But nobody's listening, or very few people are listening, and their political clout is pretty much nil at this point. Nobody's going to take them seriously. When they say, Trump's immigration policies are immoral, who's going to take that seriously when these guys were protecting a rapist like McCarrick?
Yeah, putting him in a house and hiding him.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not good. Do you think there'll be protests like we saw kind of emerging last year?
I hope so. I mean, I'd be happy to participate in one. I hope that the laity, we can't let this moment pass. This is, we've got the ball on the 10-yard line, and we need to run it into the end zone. Yeah. We have to hold all of these bad guys accountable. They've been winning for so long. The bad guys have been winning for so long. And this is our chance to really knock them out. And, we shouldn't let that go.
Yeah, it seems to me that in the summer of shame, and then August, September, October, November, even into December, there was tremendous pressure in America amongst the laity, on the bishops, on the USCCB, on Wuerl, get this McCarrick thing cleaned up. And it seems that since February, with the summit in Rome, that American Catholics are looking more and more to Rome, more and more to Francis, and their angst and their anxiety and their criticism is now more global and more Vatican focused. So I'm kind of curious as how this year will wear on, if Catholic Americans will continue to focus on what's going on in America, or they've kind of moved on and are now looking higher up. I honestly don't know.
I think, I see the Attorney General investigations as sort of like ticking time bombs. They're ticking right now. They're just ticking, and people can't hear the ticks. But when they go off, I think everybody's attention is going to go back to,
right,
how do we reform the church in a real way?
Yeah,
and get rid of the bad guys.
Right. And another question that keeps popping up is, how did these bad guys get here? And that story's coming out. I've done research on that. You've done a lot on it. We've talked about it today. It was a cabal. It was a mafia. These things you don't accidentally become the cardinal of D.C. You don't accidentally become the rector of the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception, right? These things are connected, right? And people are figuring that out.
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't happen overnight. It's modernism was gathering power and momentum for decades. It goes back, the roots of modernism go back to the Enlightenment. One could even argue they go back to the Renaissance, but they were gathering strength. Modernism was gathering strength year after year after year, and modernism laid the groundwork for the gay mafia, because it was fundamentally relativistic. It was striking at the roots of the church's moral edifice, and it was on the side of a subjective morality that would justify homosexuality, both in society at large and in within the priesthood.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I think it really starts to take root in the 18. Well, you start seeing things in the 1840s and 1850s, but it's already taking root. And you have Leo the 13th and Pius the 10th in the late 1800s, right at the turn into the 1900s, talking about it inside the church.
Right.
Inside. So, yeah. Okay, well, George Neumeyer, he is a contributing editor at the Spectator, American Spectator. And your book is The Political Pope, How Pope Francis is Delighting the Liberal Left and Abandoning Conservatives. You want to say anything about that?
Well, he, you know, yeah, the Pope Francis really represents the culmination of modernism, I would say. He's the modernist pope, you know, par excellence. And everything that we've talked about, you know, all the problems we've talked about, he really personifies and has done absolutely nothing to erase. And my book goes into that and explains why he holds the views that he does. And I just tried to basically lay out as objectively as possible what he has said and what he has done, which indicates that he is not, he doesn't seek to reform the church. He's really seeking to destroy the church.
Yeah. Interesting. And then for people to help support you and do some of this journalism, you have a GoFundMe page, and I think it's called George Neumeyer's Journalism Fund. Is that the name of it?
That's right. Yes. Yeah. And I could use some help because reporting, especially reporting, is very costly. Mm-hmm. It requires travel. It requires, I don't get paid that much, you know, I'm a contractor. So I have to find ways to, you know, alternative sources of income in order to sustain reporting, you know, because it takes a long time to report a piece. And you have to make money while you're working on a piece. And also, yeah, travel is a big expense. If in order to investigate or chase down a lot of these leads, I would have to go to a lot of different places. And frankly, I try to do as much as possible just off the phone or using a phone. But I found that physically going to the ground zero of a story is absolutely essential to uncovering it. And so that's why I'm asking that's one of the principal reasons why I'm asking people to help me out financially.
Great. So you can find that on your Facebook page. You can find it on your Twitter. Follow George on Twitter. Follow him on Facebook. The links are there. We'll also include the link in the show notes. And George, thanks for coming on today. We usually end with a Latin word of the week and a prayer. And so the Latin word I chose this week was basilica, which relates to relates to Greek. It's not Latinate, but basileia means kingdom. So a basilica is a royal hall, a building dedicated for royal meetings. And so there's cathedrals, which are for bishops, but the basilica is really like, you know, higher than a cathedral in a way, right? And so our basilica is the royal hall of Jesus and Mary. You know, this is dedicated to Our Lady. So that the royal hall would have anything that's impure in it is just scandalous, absolutely scandalous. So we need to pray and make reparations for that regarding this great basilica in D.C. And again, if you haven't been to the Basilica of Immaculate Conception, D.C., it's something to behold from the outside and the inside.
Right.
Yeah. So, okay, we'll close in a prayer and we'll sign off. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Amen. Almighty God, gracious Father, we ask that you would purify your church. We ask that you would purify your cardinals, your bishops, your priests, yes, even your pope. And we ask that you would guard and protect all those people who earnestly seek to worship and love Jesus Christ inside the Catholic Church. And we ask that you increase our faith and also protect us as well. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, George Neumeyer, thanks for being on. If you like this video, please subscribe. Please like. Even better, please hit the share button and share this video on Facebook. Share it on Twitter or Instagram or any social media account you're on. And until next time, God bless. Bye.